Hey, welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Puppet Masters and Castle Freaks, the internet's leading and possibly only all things Charles Band podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jared Hornbeck, and I'm really happy to be coming to you again from that castle in Romania. I mean, I just keep finding myself here. No, I'm kidding. I'm coming from a snowy apartment in Brooklyn, New York. And who's here with me today?
Well, hi, it's Steve Guntley coming down here from Austin, Texas. Very excited to be here today for a very special episode. We're not covering a movie today, but we are speaking to somebody who is in the tier of like the names that we've mentioned most on this podcast. One of the most important figures of our show, just in terms of sheer volume of amount of amazing stuff that he's done. Who are we talking to today, Jaren?
We're talking about a director, a writer, editor, somebody whose name I've used so many times on the show that unfortunately for him, I feel like we're already friends. And so maybe that's the energy that I'm bringing into this thing. Talking about Ted Nicolau. Ted, we're so gracious that you agreed to come on here and join us. How's it going?
Hey, thanks, Jared. Thanks, Steve. Thanks for having me.
So
things
excited.
Are good here. It's kind of cool and rainy in Los Angeles. Sorry
oh,
about
yeah.
the snow you're getting in Brooklyn.
Yeah, it's, we had a really unseasonably mild December, and now we're getting hit with a really cold January, which I think is fine. I mean, it's winter, so we're prepared for it. But I feel like we got virtually no snow, and we've already had one reasonably significant snowfall here and then a dusting. Steve, what about you down there? Are you getting anything yet, or just cold temperatures?
We dodged it. It's a balmy 40 degrees in Texas right now, which is pretty good for us. But we didn't have any big ice storms like we did last year that almost killed the entire state of Texas. So I think we're good.
Yeah, I mean, I was worried because I saw Ted Cruz at an airport, so I figured things were getting bad down there in Texas.
He's fleeing to warmer climes. But I mean, we're just unbelievably excited to have Ted here. We've spoken about so many of your films, either ones that you've directed or ones that you've been involved in the crew in some way or another. You're of the tier that is spoken about the most because you've just contributed so much to both Full Moon and Empire, and we're just thrilled to have you here. Now we kind of wanted to ask just about like how you got into the business, but you are very intrinsically tied with a local Texas legend around here because you kind of cut your teeth working on one of the most infamously difficult and challenging film productions of all time that also resulted in one of the greatest movies ever made. You started working on the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, is that correct?
Yeah, basically, I came from Dallas. I grew up in Dallas and came to the University of Texas in 1967. And was studying pre-med to become a doctor and made friends with another kind of hippie fellow that was in the same classes as I was named Daniel Pearl, who's gone on to be a great cinematographer. Mm-hmm. And together we started going to the film clubs around the campus and seeing some great art films. And both of us about the same time decided, screw this pre-med, let's go get in the film department. So we started studying film. And in the course of that, Daniel got an offer to shoot Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And he brought me on as the sound man. So that was basically my first legitimate job in the film business. And we did that film. It was, like you say, a very difficult shoot and full of bizarreness and dangers. And then after that, we formed a film production company and did commercials and public service announcements and things like that for Austin. And then eventually everybody bailed from Austin and moved to Los Angeles. So I kind of followed the trail of Texans that were coming out to work in the film business.
That's amazing. So when you were working on this movie, I mean, it was your very first film production. Did you have any kind of sense that this movie was going to be as special and as singular as it was? Or were you just kind of nose to the grindstone, like just kind of get this done and learn what I can?
Basically, we were film students and kind of snotty film students and thought we knew everything like most young people do. And the production seemed very confused and a little bit scattershot. And Toby took a long time to make decisions, and we sat around waiting a lot. And so we didn't really know what how the film would turn out, and didn't really expect that much. But after Toby sat with it in the cutting room for a really long time and put it together as best it could be put together, when we saw it, it was staggering how real it felt and how horrifying it was. So yeah, I mean, we had no idea, but we kind of applied the best craft that we could to it.
I mean, that movie's been canonized in so many ways. I don't know if you're aware, the house where that was shot, like the Sawyer house, is now a restaurant called Hooper's.
Yeah,
my girlfriend took me there this year for my birthday, so like I got to go out and see the actual house, and it was so cool. It was such a, I think they actually moved it because it was in Round Rock at the time, right? And then that's become very like suburbanized and very kind of gentrified. It's not really the same Round Rock that was back in the 70s, but I believe they moved the house and kept it totally intact.
Wow. That's gonna be
what
super
kind of food
cool.
Is it? It's like just Southern cooking or
yeah, it's just kind of like
stuff like that.
Yeah, steaks, like kind of pub food, you know, but like
a lot of human body parts.
Yeah,
more so than other restaurants.
I had a big chunk of ear in my steak, which was weird. Yeah, but they've got like memorabilia on the walls. They've got all kinds of signatures from Gunnar Hansen and actual rubber prosthesis from Grandpa and things like that. So that was
cool.
Very cool.
Yeah.
That was very cool.
Yeah.
I check it out if you get a chance, if you're around the area.
Sure.
So how did you end up crossing paths with Charles Band for the first time?
Well, I came out to Los Angeles, and first job I got was through another Texan, Larry Carroll, working as an editor on a film called Roar, which was another insane production.
Legendary. Legendary. The production Hedren. Of that one.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I worked on that with Larry Carroll in the editorial department for, you know, 6 months or so. And then the floods came and wiped out the cutting rooms, and Larry Carroll took off to produce another film. And I stayed on with Roar for a while as we kind of cleaned up everything from the mud of the floods. And then Larry Carroll and another film school friend of mine, David Schmoller, were producing a movie and directing a movie for Charles Band called Tourist Trap. And they hired me away from Roar to work on Tourist Trap. And so that started kind of my relationship with Charles Band. At the time, I didn't know Charlie very well, and basically he'd stop by the cutting room every once in a while, and you could see how much he loved movie making. So we cut that film, my wife and I, and then Charlie kind of asked me to doctor another film called The Daytime Ended, and that the editor had left and the director had quit. And so I did that, and that kind of set me off on a path of being Charlie's kind of favorite editor for a few years.
The Daytime Ended, if I'm correct, that's a big, was that one with a lot of Dave Allen stop motion stuff in it?
Yeah, it's got
a
lot of Dave Allen stop motion.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Kind of a crazy, kooky film, but you know, we did the best we could to kind of fix it in the cutting.
Yeah. Well, I knew you were going to bring up Tourist Trap at some point, probably very early on. And so that's why I'm wearing the t-shirt, because I like to come prepared for these types of things. And Tourist Trap, one of our earlier episodes from this past summer.
Yeah, we love that.
We all really, I had seen the movie before, but it was great to have a discussion about it. And we really liked a lot of the aspects of that movie, you know, how it got that G rating somehow, or PG rating rather, was kind of crazy. Some of the imagery in there is pretty striking and pretty memorable. It's just a lack of gore, which I think is fine. But that's a nice, and David Schmoller is someone we've talked about on the show a lot too, because he directed the first Puppet Master. You know, he's been sort of behind a couple other Empire and Full Moon projects that we haven't maybe discussed proper on the show yet, but we will soon. So I sort of enjoy, Ted, you know, we've read a bunch of books about both Empire, Full Moon, Charlie Band's autobiography, and other things like that. And one of the things I like is when you start to hear these names of people together, like you're talking about friends you had from film school in Texas, it reminds me of this like fun kind of like a guerrilla filmmaking version of like the film brats from USC. You know, it's like you always hear the Spielbergs and Lucases and people together, De Palma. I love the fact though that like you guys who we've been talking about in these movies all have this sort of same origin. It's just nice. It gives you a sense of like what this community is like, and presumably a group of really committed and, you know, people who really look out for each other and promote each other's success. And that's just nice to hear when we hear one person talk about someone else.
Yeah,
we were very close for a long time, that, you know, between Daniel Pearl, David Schmoller, Larry Carroll, and a guy named Courtney Gooden, who was kind of our, in film school, our technical genius and sound man. It was interesting to have kind of a tight group of friends who could kind of share work around. And that, I guess it sort of, everybody became more competitive as time went on and the stakes grew. And so people kind of grew apart a little bit, but we all still know each other. And Daniel Pearl, who was my best friend in college, is still a really close friend. So we managed to kind of get through the whole, like, you know, somebody gets successful, everybody gets jealous, competition, blah, blah, blah. We kind of, you know, surpassed that by now.
Nice. Well, that's good to hear. That's good to hear. Now, we recently covered the movie The Dungeon Master, which if we're not mistaken, and sometimes like records with movies like this tend to be a little lost or a little spotty, but is this your film director debut?
Shorts in film school, I directed a lot of shorts, but Dungeon Master, I started out as the editor of the film, and it was basically Charlie's way of testing new directors to see who he might hire for the expanding Empire production slate that he was planning for the future. So it included John Beekler, who was kind of Charlie's favorite makeup effects guy, David Allen, who's Charlie's stop motion animation genius, and Peter Manoogian, who became like one of the producers and directors of a lot of movies for Charlie. And Rosemary Turco, who kind of fell off after that film. Anyway, I edited, it was basically a lot of shorts put wrapped around a story that Charlie had directed. And by the time I was editing, I was kind of watching these sequences thinking, Jesus, I could direct as well as any of these people. so why didn't he ask me to do something? So basically, in the end, the film came out short. And I said, Charlie, why don't you get me to direct one more episode? And he said, oh, yeah, sure, why not? And so I got 2 days of shooting, some cool locations, and went out and shot it. And he liked it, and we put it in the film. And that was kind of the beginning of my directing career for Charlie.
That's amazing to hear, because like Steve mentioned, we just covered The Dungeon Master recently. When this episode drops, it will have been about a month or so that episode dropped. And it was just, it's just fun to have a different perspective, because we spoke to Jeffrey Byron for that episode. Yeah. And yeah. So we got sort of what it was like, you know, an actor's perspective on why maybe Charlie, you know, chose who he chose for these segments. And he told us a story about a kind of coaxing him, Charlie, to let his brother direct one of the segments. And so it's just, now it's fun to hear from a crew member and one of the directors, you know, it's maybe a slightly different take on it, but we both kind of said that The Dungeon Master was a movie that missed us as kids. Like I only really found out about it in reading in hindsight about Empire. And we both kind of landed on the fact that it was this computer-driven anthology movie. And if we had discovered it as kids, it probably would have been among our favorites.
Yeah.
I bet.
It's got that real kind of playful sense of imagination to it. If you know, there is a very real sense of like, this is the adult equivalent of like kids playing with action figures in the playground. You know, you're putting them in all these wild different situations, and everybody's just having a great time. And it was a really infectious kind of movie.
Yeah, it was very like a fantastical and but not too scary and very playful and fun, and the each of the vignettes was really kind of interesting in its own right.
Yeah,
it was kind of a, you know, it was an odd little movie, and maybe you didn't see it because it didn't get that much exposure or distribution. But yeah, that was the beginning.
Yeah. Well, that's fantastic. I mean, we also recently, we've covered so many of your movies so far, and we still have so many to go, which is amazing. I mean, you're so prolific with Full Moon and Empire, but we recently discussed what by all means should be more of a cult classic than it is, the film Terrorvision. We had a hoot with that movie. That's one we've both seen a few times, and it was just a delight. And that, so is this your first like feature length Empire film, or there was a movie in between, correct? You worked with was it Savage Island?
Oh, Savage Island, I think maybe came after Terrorvision.
Oh, it came after.
Maybe okay. Not. I'm not really sure actually of the timing of that, but Savage Island was a whole other thing, basically, of combining two really cheesy movies into one movie and writing dialogue to try to make a story, and then shooting the wraparound. So yeah. It wasn't really I don't really claim it as one of my, you know, darling babies. Whereas Terrorvision was, you know, was at that moment, Charlie and was trying to create theatrical distributions for the movies, and and he bought the studio, the old Dino De Laurentiis studios outside of Rome, and was trying to promote film production in these studios. And so he did Troll, Terrorvision in Italy, and I think Eliminators was the third of those films that he was going to distribute in Mexico with Peter Manoogian directing. So Terrorvision, his style at the time was to basically come up with the poster art first and then invite you in and say, okay, here's the poster. What, you know, which of these posters appeals to you? And so I saw this poster of the monster coming out of a TV set, and I had edited enough of John Buechler's creations to know the strengths and the limitations of those creatures. And I said, Charlie, could I make this kind of a science fiction comedy? And he agreed to that, which was kind of unusual at the time because his movies were kind of straightforward fantasy horror movies. So I wrote the script, and we cast it and shot it in Italy, an amazing experience, and edited it. And then the movie came out, and in the three movies that Charlie tried to release theatrically, maybe Troll actually, you know, caught on and made some money. Terrorvision, nobody understood it. It was a movie kind of written for stoners and people like myself at the time, you know. We thought it was really funny, and you know, with the cast that we had, Garrett Graham and Mary Warrenoff and Diane Franklin. And
Jonathan Price. To ask you about the casting and how you landed on some of those amazing genre people.
We got just really, really lucky. I mean, I at the time we were going to this nightclub in Hollywood called Club Lingerie that had great music, live bands, and I would see Mary Warnoff there a lot. And so she was in my brain. I really wanted Mary Warnoff because Eating Raoul had come out, and she was kind of very interesting actress. We called her in casting, and I called her in for the part of the Elvira kind of Medusa character, the TV host.
Oh, yeah.
And she said, "Dad, you know what? Everybody would call me in for this part, but what really interests me is the part of Raquel, the mother of the family," which is funny because Mary Warnoff is not a maternal type of a person. but we had Mary Warnoff. We were really lucky that Garrett Graham was available to work on it. Diane Franklin came in and just killed us with her audition. John Grise came in, was a little old for the part, but he was so damn funny and was able to kind of give that role a lot of qualities. So we got super, super lucky on the casting. Finished the film, thought, oh boy, this is really funny. and went into the theaters, and nobody understood it, and people hated it, and critics really hated it. So it was like a year for me of just misery and sadness, you know, that my film was so,
that's just unfortunate.
Yeah, so ridiculed by people. But the funny thing is, over the years, as it became even harder to find on VHS, a cult built up around it, and kids would turn their friends onto it, and their friends would turn on other friends. And now it's like, if I go to a nightclub here in Los Angeles, there's hipsters all over the place. They go, oh, I love that movie. You did Terrorvision. I love that movie. So the satisfying thing is that even though it was so misunderstood at the time, it's become, like you say, kind of a cult. There's a cult around it, and people still turn their friends on to it. I mean, it's a kind of movie that you can watch a lot because there's so much going on in it.
Yeah, there's such a sharp like satire of suburban America in there, which I think really shines through, you know. And I think these really selfish yuppie parents and like the hyper militarized little boy and like the Lyndon LaRouche style grandpa who's got all these crazy conspiracy ideas, and like there's so much of that that is unfortunately still very relevant to today's culture.
Yeah, yeah.
But you skewered it like so perfectly, and you had an amazingly fun cast.
And very self-aware too. I mean, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that Sonny Carl Davis being Norton was not unintentional as the neighbor's name, right?
Right. Yeah. Like a honeymoon.
Exactly.
Kind of reference.
Yeah.
So you said this was kind of like a dispiriting like experience getting this sort of feedback to it. You know, obviously people came around on it eventually, but how did this kind of affect sort of your working relationship going forward? Did you like want to take a break? Did you just want to stop making movies, or did you feel more determined to kind of, you know, show them all?
You know what? I've never wanted to stop making movies, even in spite of many disappointments and getting kicked in the head in many occasions. I love the whole process of making films, from the writing the script to casting to working with the crew. For me, that's where I come alive, you know? So what it did do was kind of like, I did kind of lick my wounds for a little while, and then it kind of set me on a path of like kind of development hell at Charlie's company, because they were kind of trying to come up with new kooky titles that would be, you know, like the Avocado Women and the Jungle of Death or whatever that was. And I was supposed to do one called I Eat Cannibals. It was going to be about a survivalist camp. But they were not Charlie Band kind of movies. And so, you know, I'd write a script, I'd get notes, I'd write it again, blah, 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 and never quite got it off the ground until, so that was like about a year, year and a half of kind of just, you know, running around in circles until the movie that was going to be called Space Sluts in the Slammer came along.
That's a really good title.
That something about that film really sparked me, and I wrote a really funny kind of sex farce in space, and it was going to be really, really great. We cast it. We had the costumes designed. I was going to shoot it on the leftover sets from Arena, the Peter Medavian film. Went over to Italy to start pre-production, and got a call from Charlie that the company was closed down. And so that, you know, was, you know, yet another kind of crazy crash and burn moment of the movie that I thought was going to be kind of a really fun, sparkling film to do, just died completely. Oh. And I came back to the States, and somehow I didn't bring the script, I guess. And up till now, which is what, God, 30, 40 years, 35 years later, didn't have a copy of the script. You know, if it was on a, you know, floppy disk, I had no way to get it out of the floppy disk, threw away all my floppy disks. And finally, Charlie's son, Zalman, found the script when he was going through some, you know, some of the storage spaces. So I finally have the script, and it is as funny as I remember it being.
Oh, that's amazing. That was, is there a chance that's getting revived? Is our are we gonna see a version
probably
of that?
Not by Charlie. It's a little bit ambitious in its scope of like space travel and monsters and stuff like that. I mean, I might be able to convince him to do it at some point. I would love to bring that film back to life.
Well, if you're casting project, if you're casting for a space slut, you know, I'm throwing my hat in the ring. You know, if you need, I'm ready. I'm ready to go to the slammer if I need to.
To find two more ready, willing participants than right here. Ted, was that a project entirely separate of or separate to Assault of the Killer Bimbos? Because I know that's a pretty revered Empire title, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, you were somewhat involved in that one, maybe after the fact.
Yeah, basically, Anita Rosenberg and her partner wrote the script, and they gave her the opportunity to direct it, and they started shooting, or no, they didn't start shooting, so she was going to direct it. Somehow, Charlie and his wife at the time, Debbie Dion, who was kind of like the story editor of the company, they were not happy with the script and didn't think it was funny enough. So they asked me to do a rewrite on it. So basically, I just kind of holed up in my house for like 2 weeks before they started shooting and kind of rewrote the script and hopefully made it funnier and more smartly funny. And so that was basically my involvement on that film.
Okay.
Well, so Empire's shutting down, Full Moon is sort of ascendant, you know, kind of taking its place. And that kind of leads us to the series that you're probably best known for, Subspecies. Now, a couple months ago, we had two of your cast members from the later movies, Denise Duff and Kevin Spiritus. They came on and talked
cool.
to us. They were delightful, and they had so much love for you, and they were like just really ebullient in talking about you. But neither of them were there for the production of that first movie. And everything I've read about that first movie is that it's one of the most challenging productions in all of the Full Moon canon. And I would just love to hear your perspective on working in that. What was it like being in this really tumultuous part of the world, as like that? You guys were the first American film ever shot in Romania, correct?
Crazy.
Yeah. Basically, after the revolution, which was in like December of 1989, mm-hmm. A guy came to Charlie, who he was an expatriate Romanian, and said, "Hey, I could, if you pay for the American costs, I can put a deal together that the Romanian government will pay for the local costs of the film." So that's a kind of deal that Charlie can't pass up. So he sent me to Romania first before we started shooting, just to scout locations and report back whether it was even something that would be possible. So I went over there not really knowing what to expect. And it was the craziest sort of society, and kind of like really, you know, still reeling from the revolution and from what it would mean sure. to become a democracy. But I met Vlad Paunescu, who was mm-hmm. going to be the cinematographer, who ended up kind of owning the studio, Castel Films. His girlfriend at the time, who's now his wife, Juana Tofan, now Paunescu, who was the costume designer. And Vlad didn't speak any English, and she spoke a little broken English, so we could kind of communicate. And we spent a week kind of traveling around the country, going to see castles and fortified monasteries and ruins and everything that we would be able to shoot there. And when we came back to Bucharest, we all went and had dinner. And, you know, dinner at that time was like undercooked chicken or sausages and greasy French fries, and not much was available anywhere. Even in the hotel, you could be in the finest hotel and the waiters would ignore you for hours. We kind of sat down with a Romanian producer whose company was going to be kind of the shell company for the film, and had sausage dinner. And he looked at me and said, "Okay, you're going back to America tomorrow. I think you'll never return to Romania." And I was like, "Oh yeah, maybe we'll see. Came back to the States, and just remembered the amazing locations that we'd be able to shoot and told Charlie, yeah, let's do it. So when we went to shoot the film, it was September to start pre-production, and everything moved at a snail's pace. The AD said, if you can get one thing done in a day here in Romania, consider yourself lucky. So basically, you know, we scouted locations, we were casting, we were doing costumes, and every day there was some like breakdown of a car, a guy with a key to get into a location didn't show up, and there's only one key and you can't get in. The studio was just fallen down, you know, in disrepair. The stunt people were drunk. So the shambles of the production were like really hanging over us. The producer who kind of originally talked Charlie into doing the film ended up locking himself in his hotel room to avoid the crew that was always pissed off because they weren't getting paid on time. Vlad Paunescu and Juana basically kind of took me under their wing, and every night I'd go to their apartment and we'd get drunk and you know, just talk about how we were going to get through this. And Vlad ended up kind of commanding the crew in a way that kind of kept the production together. He and I were able to communicate enough to kind of get the shots. The actors were a whole other problem because they, it was freezing cold. The hotel had almost no food. Wine was $1 a bottle. And Anas Hove, who plays Radu, was like such a drinker in those days. And Michael Watson, who plays his brother Stefan, was another drunk. And so dinners would become just like mad screaming matches and broken wine glasses. And Laura Tate and Michelle McBride kind of got swept into the drinking. And so it was fighting with the actors, fighting with the crew, against the cold, against a schedule that just kept expanding in front of us because nothing was getting done on, you know, day by day, against film stock never arriving on time. And so we were having to economize every day and what we were going to shoot. Somehow we managed to get to the end of the production, just as like the celebration of the previous year's revolution was going on and people were taking to the streets and soldiers were firing rubber bullets. And Anas got kicked out of hotel after hotel because of drunken madness. It was, you know, I was reduced to tears sometimes just, you know, trying to keep it all together. Ended up writing a journal every night just to convert the day's insanity into some kind of humor for myself to kind of get through it, which ended up being a really great kind of document of the production and that period of time in Romania. Anyway, we finished the film, got the hell out of Romania, and like everything else, like after a month or so, the kind of bad memories start to fade and the good memories remain. And you sort of remember, oh, it was really cool walking down that empty street and stopping in at a bar and having a drink or getting drunk with Vlad and Juana and laughing about things. And after a month or two, you go, wow, that was actually one of the most interesting experiences of my life, you know? And when Paramount liked Subspecies, the first one, and asked for some sequels, I was like really happy to go back and kind of dive into that experience again, because you don't really get that kind of surreal lifetime experience very often, and it's really addicting, you know.
I mean,
that's an amazing story.
We commented on it when we covered the first Subspecies movie, where like having that verisimilitude of the real life Romanian settings really kind of sets that movie apart. You have that amazing scene of like that festival with the masks, like coming through the graveyard. And it's just like, it's this moment of like beautiful surreality that really kind of elevates that film. And now, and so we've talked about Subspecies 2 as well, which full disclosure, both of us kind of consider our favorite Full Moon movie. Like it's the favorite one that we've watched. And we were noting just that, like, immediately this feels like a more confident, assured, authorial movie. It feels like more like the first movie was like you were taking a job, and then the second movie is like, all right, this is a Ted Nikoloff franchise. This is going to be my vision going forward. Is that how you felt about it going into it? Did you feel kind of energized by it, or did you kind of
basically when the first film, when I scouted locations, met people, saw the equipment we were going to be working with, I kind of resigned myself to this movie is going to be like a little chamber film. You know, it's going to be very European. It's going to be very kind of gothically kind of doomed. And when it came to Subspecies 2, I had the confidence of, okay, we did a pretty good job given the difficulties we encountered. Vlad Paunescu was more confident and our friendship was a lot more strong. Juana's costumes were amazing. Anas Hove, who was such a handful, like a handful of dynamite in Subspecies 1, I sort of had a conversation with him and I said, okay, look, let's do this. Getting drunk on the set was really detrimental to Subspecies 1. I had to pull the plug on numerous days of shooting because it was too dangerous because people were too drunk. So let's make this deal for Subspecies 2. No drinking on the set. And I will come to your dressing room when they're taking off the makeup at night and we'll share a bottle of wine together, you know, and he agreed to that. And, you know, Anas is a handful, but he's got the biggest heart of almost anybody that I know. And yeah. I love him dearly. And over the years, that love has grown. And basically when we proved that we could work together in a way that wasn't detrimental to the film, and still there are blowups and he screams, he's a screamer, and you just sort of have to accept that he's a handful. But I think that and the fact that I wrote the script for Subspecies 2 and 3, I didn't really write the script for Subspecies 1, and I did some rewriting on it, but I sort of had it in my head what it was going to be, and I knew the locations, so there was a lot of pre-production work that was already done from the first one. And then replacing Laura Tate with Denise Duff, and Denise is like a super trooper, you know, and like a great actress to have when you're traveling because she is so comfortable everywhere she is. And Michelle McBride, who was like a real, oh no, Michelle was the first one. So it was Denise. Oh, and Melanie Shatner, mm-hmm. who kind of came into it a little suspicious, but ended up kind of joining the band. And Kevin Spiritas, who was also a really great trooper, and because he and Denise Duff are such close friends, or became such close friends on the show, the cast wasn't as much of a problem as it was on the first film. And so the whole experience was a lot more conducive to just creative concentration.
Steve, I was really glad that you asked that question, actually, because that was a question that I had here worded slightly differently, which was that when you look at a lot of the Full Moon franchises, a lot of them, you know, some of them have entries that are directed by Charlie. You've got a couple of Dave DiPotos, you've got a David Allen, you know, in Puppet Master, and a David Schmoller. And for a lot of this stuff, you take, like Steve mentioned before, sort of a workmanlike approach to it. But I think when you watch the Subspecies sequels, like I was really wondering, and you started to kind of answer the question on your own about like what it was about this property that made you want to take more creative control and kind of decide, oh no, this is going to be like my thing, where I'm going to do all of these. I'm going to be the person making presumably most of the creative choices, you know, writing, directing all of these things. It's a really great consistence of like tone and standard, where I think, you know, if you look at some of the other franchises, you have higher level entries and lower level entries, but you have more of sort of a baseline with subspecies, I think, especially once you get into two and three, which really kind of go together. And so I was thinking, like, since the first one was so tumultuous, you mentioned the memory, the bad memories fade and all of the good ones remain. And you think like, oh, I can do that. And I know times were getting less turbulent in Romania also, but like, what was it about this property that made you want to be like in it for, oh, okay, I'll do subspecies too, but no, it almost feels like you knew you were going to keep this going. What was it about
that? I was never a Dracula fan as a kid. You know, I was like, I was into Frankenstein and science fiction films and atomic monster kind of movies, and vampires always seemed, especially Dracula, just kind of bland and boring to me. The only vampire movies I really loved was like Carl Dreyer's A Vampire and Nosferatu, but they were so old-fashioned. But when Charlie proposed subspecies, it wasn't really, you know, the script was okay, but, you know, could have gone the Dracula way or could have gone the Nosferatu way. But when I saw the locations, I was like, wow, this is, there is a way to make this movie and make it authentic. So I came from not really caring much about vampires to understanding or appreciating the depth of character, the depth of kind of misery and loneliness and all of the things that I think make the subspecies films interesting, which is that you're telling a story not about the victims of a vampire, but of a vampire. And so the monsters are kind of the central characters of the story.
Yeah.
And something about that really appealed to me, just the kind of emptiness and weight of eternity on Radu in the stories. And so I don't know if it's ego or possessiveness or friendship with Anas and Denise that kind of drove me to want to keep making the subspecies films. Two and three were shot together, so that was like inevitable. Number four, which is sort of the bastard baby of the whole bunch, because two and three were done with when Charlie had the deal with Paramount, and so money was not really a problem. Subspecies four, we wanted to do it so badly that we kind of accepted, okay, there's not very much money here. We can't go traveling to distant locations. We've got to keep it all around Bucharest. And so, you know, finding kind of Gothic locations around Bucharest is more challenging. So basically, Subspecies 4 could have kind of ended the franchise because it was just like not as well received, didn't look as good. Vlad, by that time, was busy running the studio. So Adolfo Bartoli, a great cinematographer, but somehow didn't quite have the subspecies kind of grit to it. The story was a little scattered. I like it. And when I watch it now, there's a lot of sequences that I think really are work. But okay, it didn't quite work like two and three, which just kind of were full on kind of Gothic stories. So Subspecies 4 was like, okay, maybe that's the end. And then Charlie asked me to write another one, and that was like probably 2000 or 1999 or something like that. I wrote Subspecies 5, and by that time Radu had been killed so many times and Denise had gotten away, and then he'd been resurrected, and I was like, I don't know, man, I don't really see the story of Michelle anymore in the way that we've been kind of telling it. From, you know, every film is just a direct continuation of the one before. So I wrote a prequel, and then that sat on the shelf for 20 years because at that point it was so ambitious that there was no way that Full Moon could really afford to do it until recently, when we were able to do number five. And ultimately it was like Denise and Anas and Kevin and I had been talking about this movie for decades, you know, how much we wanted to do it and loved the idea of doing it. So we consider ourselves really fortunate that we were able to, you know, find a new location because Romania was too expensive now. in Serbia, mm-hmm. and got to go have another adventure, you know, making another subspecies.
And that movie was so fun. We had such a great time mm-hmm. watching that one. We haven't done an episode on it yet, but we got to get, you know, and that's one of the rare Full Moon movies that did get a bit of a theatrical release. Like it was showing us like Alamo draft houses mm-hmm. around the world, which is really cool and kind of a testament to how popular that series is. I was a little curious too, like in talking about the difference between subspecies one and two, from my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, my understanding is that the first subspecies was a classic Charlie Band production in that they had a poster first and then kind of built a movie around it later. So the biggest change that you see between subspecies one and two is actually the subspecies themselves, the titular little characters. Was it your decision to kind of fade them out a little bit and focus more on the gothic romance storyline?
Yeah, actually, I really do not like puppets and don't like working with them. I mean, you know, okay, there are some.
They're drinking on set all day. They're always causing problems. Yeah.
I mean, the subspecies one, if you look at it, it was, you know, we were going to shoot kind of forced perspective, you know, stuntmen in subspecies costumes. Mm-hmm. And the sets were built at God knows what kind of expense, giant throne, big jail cell, bars. And
those looking great. We've seen that behind the scenes stuff. It looks incredible. Yeah, either way. Yeah.
We shot those tests and they were so goofy. And in a matter of seconds, the flesh-colored subspecies suits would turn to just black from the dust and grime on the floor of the studio. Charlie Solomon says, this is ridiculous. So we got Dave Allen to kind of do the subspecies, but the subspecies didn't cast shadows. They were didn't really fit with the sets very well. And I was like, this is bullshit. You know, if we're going to do another movie, but we don't really have the money to create the creatures in a way that is realistic, and at the cost of those creatures, you can't really put them into the entire movie. They're basically little vignettes of creatures. I don't even like the creatures that much. Subspecies two starts with the subspecies kind of resurrecting Radu, and then they do kind of fade out over time, you know, with when David Allen died, you know, there was who's left to do any of the stop motion animation at Charlie Band's kind of budgets. So, yeah, we were going to have a subspecies in number five, mm-hmm. But the puppet that was built didn't articulate well enough, and we shot some tests of the kind of formation of the subspecies. And that was a big disaster. It took us, you know, quarter of a day of shooting just to kind of set that up. And I was like, okay, this is, if they're not going to, you know, add to the seriousness of the movie, for me, the vampire kind of melodrama that's going on is so much more interesting and compelling, you know, even for an audience. I mean, I know that there are a lot of people that love the little subspecies, and I apologize that I hate them so much.
Here's the thing, not miss them in part five.
Full Moon Full Moon has no shortage of like scary little guys, so I think we're okay. I think we're all right. Yeah, I mean, I at the very least, I love that you gave them like a really lovely kind of send off in a way at the beginning of Subspecies Two with one of the most impressive visual effects sequences in the entire Full Moon catalog that we've seen so far. That amazing, it looked kind of like Rob Bottin, John Carpenter's The Things inspired with the tendrils, like putting Radu's head back together. Like, you know, so they got one little moment there to have a great little send off. But yeah, I think the later movies definitely stand on their own without them. But I was just curious if that was ever your decision or if that just kind of organically happened, but
It was my decision and organically happened, and Charlie still harasses me about it because even from the very first subspecies, he harasses me because the poster had little subspecies carrying the girl, and I was like, Charlie, I like the script. Could we do it without the subspecies? And just looked at me like, are you crazy? This is what I've sold, you know? So
But it still kind of works. You can still think of the vampires as like a subspecies in a way. Like you can, the title can still apply to them. Which is great.
You did such a great job with the second movie that, like, after the subspecies themselves are done helping Radu reassemble himself, I don't think there's a moment when you're watching Subspecies 2 or subsequently Subspecies 3 where anyone ever goes, hey, where are those little guys again? Like, I feel like you're brought into, there's so much amazing. Yeah, there's so many amazing things to latch on to in Subspecies 2. Even when it seems as simple as, I say simple, meaning like narratively, not necessarily simple to pull off as a filmmaker, but stuff like Michelle, you know, Denise Duff, just walking down the cobblestone streets and then finding the heavy metal bar to hang out in, and then Radu with the cool, you know, all the shadow work at the train station, and then having the shadow sort of beat him around the corner and shrink down. Like, I felt like all of those effects kind of supplanted the need for having these little creatures in there. And there's so much cool stuff like that in the second and third movie that I just feel like I can't imagine a person, you know, I understand Charlie's argument about that's what he sold on the poster, but really, like, I don't think there's a single person watching saying like, there's not enough subspecies in this subspecies movie for me. I think the title takes on something completely different.
Yeah, that's good. Well, I think Anna Sobe commands the screen so well, and he's created such an incredible character. And the kind of dynamic between Radu and Michelle, Denise Duff's creation, you know, it's that's subspecies for me. And hopefully we can, you know, I wanted to make a serious movie, not a, you know, little creature movie that has nothing to do with vampires. So that, you know, I stand behind that, you know.
I think it's the right choice.
I mean, I just want to ask you real quick. So when we talked to Denise and Kevin, I was saying how impressed I was with the opening, with Michelle's opening scenes in Subspecies 2 and how she's taking over from an established character. And she has so much to do with no dialogue in the first few minutes. And we don't have to spend a ton of time on this, but I was just curious, like, was there a lot of direction involved there, or did you find that she kind of naturally knew what to do because she, you know, we were introduced to her in the cat laying in the cast in the coffin, and then she has to convey that she knows who she is, where she is, and what's going on without any written exposition except a very brief voiceover before the scene actually even happens. So just was there a lot of direction in getting her to play it a certain way, or did you find that she made the naturally the right choices and it was easy?
You know, with Denise, there's always discussion, you know, and we talked a lot about how she would move and how she would move when she, as she's becoming a vampire, and kind of the tension in her fingers and the kind of floatiness of her walk and her kind of need and terror at what's happening to her, and at the same time as of course there's direction involved, but she's also really a sensitive actress and understands very quickly what to do and takes direction really well. With every actor that on those films, it's like a little some direction and some freedom to do kind of what works for them. And then, you know, it all kind of becomes magic when they start acting, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree with you. We had an amazing conversation with the two of them. It was so much fun to get all this behind the scenes and anecdotes and stuff like that. Steve,
and just cool to see that they've had this like 30-year like super close friendship. Like when I think we reached out to Denise first, and she's like, "Can I bring Kevin on with me?" And we're like, "Yes, of course, why not?" You know, they want any excuse to kind of like get together, and they're so goofy and fun and light together. So that's a cool kind of offset of your film, is that you sort of facilitated that amazing friendship. And they were a hoot to talk to. I was just curious as kind of where, you know, where, but I don't want to take up too much of your time because I could absolutely bother you all day.
I know. I was like, I could talk about subspecies for another hour, but we won't do that.
I was curious if you had like a personal favorite film that you've worked on. If you have like kind of one that you want, you want to draw people's attention to that maybe they're not as aware of.
You know, that's hard because every movie, you know, you love certain things about it. You realize your weaknesses in other ways. You understand the compromises you had to make, and you sort of hate yourself for making the compromises. So every movie is kind of, some of them are not my favorites, but a lot of them are my favorites. And for me, Terrorvision, because it looks like no other movie that I've ever seen, you know? And it's funny and smart and stupid at the same time. So for me, Terrorvision is like
tightrope to walk sometimes.
That's a tough one. Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
it's pretty great when you can pull both of those off.
It's perfectly encapsulated with the design of that monster that you come up with in that movie. It's so it's so goofy looking and so funny, and it's just, I love that monster.
It was a magical combination of a funny script, incredible luck with the casting, an amazing monster creation, production designer, Italian production designer who kind of took my ideas and took the script and then imagined this insane house for the Puttermans. And then the cinematographer giving it just kind of this garish candy colored look. Everything about that movie was plussed by every person that worked on it. And so that to me is a magical thing and something that makes it one of my favorites. Subspecies, of course, because it was a life-changing experience to work in Romania at the time that we were able to work there. It was exasperating and inspiring at the same time. I formed some of the greatest, longest friendships of my life on those films. So those films I love. And the one that never really gets mentioned or very seldom gets mentioned is one of the kids' fantasy films that I did called Dragon World.
Oh, yeah. That, we haven't covered that yet, but I'm excited to watch it.
It's a lovely movie that, because Paramount was behind the film, and this was like the family film kind of wing of Charlie's company. We had a decent budget. We had David Allen and his crew to kind of create a dragon, and we had a giant dragon head that was on a truck that basically we could shoot as a forced perspective element for scenes. We had an amazing English cast and locations throughout the UK. To me, that film was like one of those films where you feel blessed that you're able to make it, where everybody's intentions are all good toward the film, where the locations just inspire you to think of beautiful shots. Everything about that film was another kind of magical experience. And even though we shot in the UK and the weather was horrible and it screwed us up and put us over schedule to the point where Charlie kind of pulled the plug on the UK and made us go finish the film in Romania. Even that was sad because we were having such a great time in the UK. But bringing kind of the crew and the cast over to Romania and finishing the film, I can see it when I look at the movie, but to me, the story is so lovely, you know, that for me, that's like one of my favorite films too, because it has such heart.
That was one of them that really kind of crossed over too. I know that was a very popular like VHS kind of staple when that one came out. So that's really cool to hear that was a good experience too.
It was, and I think even Paramount considered a theatrical release for it for a little while, but it was a little bit too behind the times in its effects, you know, but it had some of the earliest kind of CG dragon animation. You know, it was like everybody was doing their best for that film. And that's like, nice. To me, that's sort of my job is to kind of bring that out of people.
Yeah.
But you can only bring it out of them if they're also kind of inspired to add their talents to the film.
Absolutely. Totally.
We recently covered Ted a few weeks ago, maybe a month or two ago, once this drops, We had an episode proper on bad channels, which with Becky Dark, and that episode was a ton of fun. Again, another movie we got it. We were along for the ride. That was one I was pretty familiar with the film on reputation, from what it was about. I mean, I know I've read that you were reluctant to get involved in making that movie because you found it narratively to be a little similar to Terror Vision, maybe initially. But tell us a little bit about Bad Channels, because that's also, you know, you said that you used the word kooky before, which I appreciate. And I think we can all agree that there's some kookiness in Bad Channels. And so what was it like starting that one out?
Yeah, basically, I resisted Charlie's request for me to do Bad Channels for a really long time, for a year or two even, because it was like, okay, a monster out of a TV set, monster out of a radio. I can't do it. I guess I got like hungry to do a movie eventually, and realized that, okay, not only would this be kind of a fun film to do, but it would involve some bands, and we could shoot some kind of, you know, little music videos for the bands. So somehow I eventually said yes to it. And then we got Martha Quinn and Paul Hipp to play the DJ, and the cast kind of came together in a good way. And the location was way the hell out in Ventura, like up on a mountaintop. And so that was sort of fun to go out there and shoot every night. And it was, you know, I had shot some episodes of a TV series called Lucky Luke, an Italian TV series in Santa Fe, New Mexico, for the couple of summers before that. And was able to bring the art director from that film onto this film, and who the AD who came over and started working with us too. So it was fun to bring a crew from New Mexico into Charlie's universe and to make that film. And Adolfo Bartoli, who was the director of photography, was a trip to work with. So yeah, that film, I hope it gets an upgrade to HD, because it still kind of has that VHS look on the Full Moon website.
Yeah,
but there's some fun stuff in that film. Yeah,
yeah, we had a great time with that one. We had a really fun time.
Oh, good. Glad.
And, was the our guest who came on, was that's kind of a favorite of hers, so she was really excited to talk about it. And we've had a lot of people writing in saying like, "When are you going to cover Bad Channels? This was my favorite one growing up." And like, so.
Oh, that's so cool, man! I had no idea that it was that like that well liked. You know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it absolutely is. Well, so this has been a real treat for us to be able to talk to you and get these incredible stories. We just want to thank you so much for taking the time and sitting with us and talking about this. Do you have anything you'd like to point people towards? Anything you're working on right now that you'd like a little attention towards?
Right now, basically, I'm working with Charlie on a movie called Barbenheimer.
You're doing Barbenheimer. Amazing.
Yeah, we're hoping we're going to be able to do it. It's like it'll be kind of like a return to the Terrorvision world for me. So I'm doing that. I'm writing another horror script for Anna Sove and for Stasha Nikolic, who was like
she's terrific in Species 5. Yeah,
Serbian actress. Yeah. I would encourage your fans to watch Subspecies 5 and then to write Charlie Band and ask for more subspecies, because we would love to make them, but they're not cheap in the Full Moon world. But there's so many more stories to be told. And Anas is such an incredible actor. And now we've discovered these new actors in Serbia that can kind of make the story even more interesting. So yeah, please write to Full Moon. Request more subspecies.
We talked a little bit with Denise and Kevin about the new actors who came, because we were talking about the chemistry between Denise and Kevin and how well they would just work off of one another. But then we were saying how like they had these new actors now with pretty important roles who had to acclimate themselves in. And yeah, Stasia Nikolic, I think her name is, she was really great, really commanding presence. And I forget, my apologies, I forget the name of the young man who plays off of her brother in the film.
But
he delivers a good performance as well.
Marco Filippo Filipovich. Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Well, great listeners, thank you so much for tuning in as always. If you like what we do, jump onto Apple Podcasts or Spotify and leave a 5-star rating and maybe a brief review if you feel so inclined. You can find the show on Instagram at puppetmasters_castlefreaks. You can follow me personally at _Giallo_Jerry or Steve at @MinotaurMatador. You can also find the show on X and Threads, Blue Sky, YouTube, and any other social media platform if you feel so inclined. You can find Steve promoting another show on social media as well. Steve, what show is that?
Yeah, my other show is called Cinemarcade. That's the show where we are watching movies and then playing the video games that are based on those movies and comparing and contrasting and finding all the different ways that they enhance or detract from one another. So we've been having a lot of fun doing that. You can check us out there. And thank you again to the great Ted Nicola. We're so it's just been such a thrill to be able to talk to you. So thank you so much.
Absolute pleasure.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a pleasure for me, too. Thanks for having me.
All right, y'all. All right. We will see you next time.